Welcome to all our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever across the globe you may be, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly from Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada, by Amnesty International volunteers Jim Hutchings, that's me, and Mona Hill.
That's me.
And we're part of a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're working to build a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Thanks to Canadian band Mr. Something Something from Toronto and the Afrobeat poet Ikwunga for our theme song, You Are Beautiful. Today we welcome Bonnie Morton, designated lay minister of the United Church of Canada. Bonnie significantly makes a difference in her daily work with the Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry. Welcome to Human Rights Radio, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Yes, welcome, Bonnie, and welcome to all of our listeners, and for those of you who haven't tuned in before, we hope that you will gain some knowledge and come back and join us again. So today, we want to talk about the work that Bonnie does here in Regina with the Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry, and I'll give you a little bit of background about Bonnie, is that she has a Bachelor of Human Justice and a Certificate in Dispute Resolution and Mediation. Bonnie, you've had 25 years worth of advocacy experience, and in 1991, the Keith Coase Award. Tell me about that. What was that about?
The Keith Coase Award is an award that was developed or put into place to honor the former director of the Human Justice Program at the University of Regina.
Okay.
Keith was somebody who was very active within the community, and I'd heard of him and first met people that knew him when I volunteered with John Howard Society way, way back in like 1988, 87.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. In 1999, Bonnie won the YWCA Woman of Distinction Award. And in 2001, the Helen Prize winner. And in 2005, You were the Saskatchewan Centennial Medal recipient. Holy cow, that's a lot. You've done some amazing work, obviously. If anybody needs to get a hold of Bonnie, can we give out your email address? Okay,
yes.
We'll do that at the end of the show. So here we are today to talk about the Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry and the work that you do along with Peter Gilmer. Who couldn't be with us today. He's on holidays. Lucky
yes.
Peter. Yeah. I have a copy of the Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry 2011 Annual Report, and I'm going to read the mission statement of it, and it is rooted in God's radical love expressed through compassion and action. The Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry advocates and educates with and for those seeking social and economic justice. So one of the things I thought we could start out with was about what was the purpose of the Anti-Poverty Ministry when it was created and how long ago was it created?
The Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry actually is, was our ministry grew out of the downtown chaplaincy. The downtown chaplaincy was created in 1971. And it was initially supported by the denominations that are rooted downtown, like the Baptists, the Presbyterians, the Anglicans, and the United Church. And it was because congregations wanted their ministers in the church. And the ministers knew that there was a sector of society that wasn't being ministered to, and that was the people living in poverty. And, of course, at that time, they believed that poverty was all downtown, which we know that's not the reality. So, anyway, they started the downtown chaplaincy, and the initial chaplain was Reverend Bob Gay. Mm-hmm. And the ministry was more of a charitable ministry. And then in about 1987, just before I started working with Bob Gay, the ministry went through a training process that was called organizational transformation that was initially funded by sort of the plura groups like Presbyterian, Lutheran, United Roman Catholic, and Anglicans. And it was a way of trying to get ministries and organizations that were in the communities to look at maybe changing to help meet their need in the community. So when I first started working with the Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry, I had just actually come off of welfare and was just starting university. So they asked me to participate in this process, and they said, Bonnie, when you were on social services, what would you have needed this ministry to do for you? And at that time, if you remember, we had clothing banks, we had furniture banks, and we had food banks by that time. So all of those kinds of needs were actually cared for. What wasn't in place was an organization that could help me understand what my rights and responsibilities were as somebody on social services, and to help me maneuver within the system and either speak for myself or speak for me when I couldn't or it was too dangerous for me to speak for myself. And you need to realize that low-income people, and especially people on social assistance, the fear is if I open my mouth, I'll lose the only monies that I have to be able to feed myself and keep a roof over my head and my children. So that's when the ministry decided to shift from the charitable ministry to a social justice ministry. And it wasn't too long after we started to shift into that being social justice, we started to realize we had to be more as a ministry than just a ministry that was going to advocate on behalf of people, like on behalf of individuals, because we could continue to do the same thing and win the same cases over and over and over again, but social policy wasn't changing. So our first mode of working was actually the individuals. And we realized if we were going to have to change social policy, we'd have to do some education. That policy or the social programs that we had at that time, and even now, didn't come about because the political parties of the day thought it was the right thing to do. It came about because the public believed it was the right thing to do and stood up and fought for it. So we realized we have to educate the public to get their support to do the third part of what it was that we needed to do, which is the systemic advocacy or the lobbying. That's the three areas that we now work in, is individual advocacy, public education, and systemic advocacy, or the social justice side.
Right. Okay.
And in 1995, we switched strictly over to the social justice ministry,
mm-hmm.
and that's when we got the name change as well, and we developed our mission statement to set what it is that we are and where we're coming from.
Okay, wonderful.
I'm just curious at this point, was Carmichael Outreach involved in any of this?
Carmichael Outreach would have been seen as the flip side of what we did. So they did the charity side, mm-hmm. and we did the social justice side.
Right.
And in the beginning, they were actually out of Carmichael Church.
Yes, right.
And then grew into its own ministry, and it's now not linked mm-hmm. to the churches.
Right, but it was mostly United Church, was it not?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was strictly United Church.
Yeah.
But over the years with the Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry or even the Downtown Chaplaincy, some of the other denominations kind of backed off financially. Mm-hmm. You know, it was necessary for them. And so the United Church seemed to pick up more of the funding of our ministry to the point that we became a social justice ministry of Wascana Presbytery mm-hmm. of the United Church of Canada.
Let's talk about the individual advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
How is that different than public education, for instance?
Well, public education is just talking about the realities of those people's lives and how social policy is affecting them. The individual advocacy is somebody will come to me and say, I've been cut off of welfare, or I can't get on welfare, or I have a special need that social services isn't helping me with. So we would either work with them and tell them how to do it themselves. But most people actually want us to do it because of the intimidation of the system. So what we would then do is go to the system and say, these are the needs of these individuals. How can we work it out? If we can't do that, that's called sort of the mediative approach, then we have to go into the adversarial approach and we have to do appeals. So we would represent them sort of like a lawyer would represent somebody in court. So we would go to the appeals and represent them, and hopefully we'd win. That's not always the reality, though.
Mm-hmm.
And what types of appeals would you be involved in?
Well, if somebody was denied social assistance, it would be things like shelter costs would be too low and they need it up higher, be dietary needs, transportation needs. It would also be special circumstances because right now a lot of people think that those who are on welfare are all capable of working. The reality today is that almost 80% of the caseload of people on social services who are on welfare are people with disabilities.
Right.
Are you aware that we have two welfare programs?
Maybe. Depends on what you're talking about.
We have right now welfare, or some people are calling it social services, but these two are actually social services wrapped together. The other one is a transitional employment program.
Right.
And that's the program that people who are able-bodied and could work, they're streamed into that. And it's actually the poor cousin of welfare, because this one has a cap on the utilities, so that in some cases, some of the families and individuals don't get enough to cover the cost of the utilities. So, and that's a huge problem. But on welfare, it's people who have disabilities or some form of special need, like they're pregnant, need lactation diets, you know, that kind of stuff, or just a special diet that they need. So those people would go on to welfare.
Right.
Yeah.
And I've noticed lately that there have been there's been some changes in that system where a lot of young women who may be 6 months pregnant are being told by their caseworkers that they need to go and find a job. Or young women who have a two-month-old baby are being told, you need to go out and find a job. You need to get some reliable daycare and get out there and get to work.
The reality is that if you're 6 months pregnant, who's really going to hire you?
Bingo.
It's illegal for them to deny you employment because you're pregnant, but there'll always be somebody else that has maybe a little bit better education than you do to get that job. So in reality, what are we doing to people? We're forcing them to get out the door and do major running around to try to find a job that they already know they're not going to get. And not only that, they're only going to maybe work 3 months, and then they're going to have to be off on maternity. And that's if they can work up to being 9 months pregnant, right?
If someone will hire them when they're 6 months pregnant.
That's what I said. But the reality is that most of these young women won't get employment.
That's right.
And so the system has just made them jump through a bunch of hoops that really shouldn't have happened.
Right.
And for the single-parent mothers that you're talking about with the children that are 2 months old, those women need to understand that social services can't force them to go out to look for employment until those children are 3 months old. And if they're actually breastfeeding those children, social services can't force them out into employment until they're done breastfeeding.
Right.
Because that's the special need for that child. And the reality is if you can't get proper daycare for your children, that's not your problem. That's a problem in our economic system that we don't provide child care, appropriate child care, and enough of it so that this can be a reality for people.
Yeah. Wasn't there a time when there was a promise of a daycare system that was supposed to be universal throughout the country? It seems to me I remember that there was a time.
It was coming.
That all families could have universal daycare, approved daycare with competent, trained people running the daycare and working with our children.
Yes, and then
that
we got the Harper
hasn't happened,
government.
Unfortunately.
Then we got the Harper government.
Yeah.
That was something that was promised under the Liberals. And when the Harper government came in, that actually got trashed, and they brought in that tax thing about, we're going to give you so much money per child under a certain age that stays at home and stuff like that.
Right.
So it hasn't really worked for the poorest of the poor, but it has worked very well for middle income and upper middle income and wealthy people.
Yeah.
But not for those who really need it.
Of course, what happens with that money is that it gets clawed back anyway.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you talk about individual advocacy, I'm wondering about, connecting that with public education. I've worked with people who have for whatever reason, not had the skills or the tools available to them to advocate for themselves. And so this is part of your role as an advocate, is to advocate for those people who may be having problems with social assistance or with their landlord or disability needs and employment, education, budget planning. I noticed that you do budget planning as well. What about training people with those needs to advocate for themselves? Is that something that you would do?
We have done that, mm-hmm. And it's usually been through community organizations. We would go out to the community organization and we would do advocacy training. Mm-hmm. And we have an advocacy training program that if you have enough people to pull together, mm-hmm. we will come out and do the training. And initially it's a day, maybe day and a half to do the training. And it's teaching them what advocacy is about, whether it's the individual or the systemic advocacy. And then what we expect them to do is to go out into their community and do the practical experience, like do the actual taking and helping somebody. But right. we would continue to work and support them as a support system. So mm-hmm. if they get a case and they say, this is the person that came to me, we would tell them how to approach it. We would be there to continue to guide them through it and act as that support. Mm-hmm. And then after 4 months, they would provide for us a log that outlines the advocacy they've done, not the people and not anything that says who they are or anything that would allow us to identify.
So the confidentiality is there. Yeah.
They would talk about the case and the case only and how they approached it and what they did mm-hmm. and how many hours or whatever that they mm-hmm. put into it. And that doesn't matter if it's the individual advocacy or the systemic advocacy, which is the lobbying stuff. And after 4 months, we would come back together. We would talk to them about it. They would ask us questions that may have come up for them while they were doing it, and then we would give them a certificate. And we do this also with practicum students that we get each semester from Human Justice and Social Work.
Mm-hmm.
And we've actually been finding that with that certificate, some of the folks are actually getting hired at social services.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
And let's turn that around on the concept of advocating for someone who has needs. And earlier you mentioned rights and responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I personally see advocacy as a right, that anyone who needs that help should have availability of advocacy. But what about the client's responsibilities within the context of having someone advocate for them and with them about their particular issues?
Well, their responsibility would to make sure that they give us all of the information we need. Even if they've done something that was wrong, mm-hmm. it's better that we know before we phone the department and find out that, oh, maybe they had screwed up in a mm-hmm. certain way. It would have been helpful for us to know that to begin with. So their rights are to have an advocate. You're right on that. And it actually states that in the regulations and the policy of social services.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem that we have right now is that funding to, like, welfare rights and Equal Justice for All up in Saskatoon and a couple of other organizations around the province that have done advocacy, the funding has been pulled from it. And we've seen this with conservative governments across the country, even the federal government, where any organization that's going to provide an alternative voice, and the voice of the poor is the alternative voice. And they've pulled the funding from all of it, and if they've ever given it back, it's tied into gag clauses where you can't lobby, you can't do this, you can't do that if you want it. So with women's organizations, they've given the funding back, and they've tied it into you only provide a service. You don't speak out against these services. You don't speak out against something that's not available or not there. So in other words,
complaining. We're giving you this, but you can't complain about anything?
Yes, and let's not make life better for other people. So we've seen organizations that provide these advocacy type of services have lost all of their funding. And in Saskatchewan right now, we're seeing a huge increase in our caseload in Regina. And we're supposed to be a Regina advocacy ministry, but we're advocating in North Battleford, LaRange, PA, Swift Current, Yorkton. We're starting to get more and more calls.
And how many people are working in your ministry that are able to do this?
Peter and I right now.
Two people.
Three-quarter time.
Three-quarter time who are covering along the whole province rather than just the city of Regina, as you were in the past.
Yeah, well, as you know, we're three-quarter time, and we're supposed to be like sort of it's not necessarily 9 to 5,
right.
But our job takes us more than that, and we wouldn't be able to do what we do if we were only a 9 to 5 job
so
organization.
So what I hear you saying is that you're probably working a lot of overtime.
We do.
But you don't get paid for it, I bet.
Well, our ministry can't afford to pay it.
Right, okay.
And and we have to be fair to our ministry and to our church. They mm-hmm. do everything they can, and they're
right.
really working to try to find ways to
right.
make it affordable for us to be able to do this as well. But we do get some relief by having the students from social work and human justice, and once we get them trained enough, they can step in and do some of the work with us as well. They're not there just to be gophers. They're there
right.
to do whatever
right.
Peter and I do.
So what kind of follow-up besides just inavailability of access to advocacy have you seen since Welfare Rights has been shut down?
Lack of knowledge where there's housing, because Welfare Rights had a housing registry, and I know that it's sort of parked right now with Carmichael Outreach, but it requires a lot of work. A lot of commitment needs to go into that. So right now what we're seeing is a huge gap around people being able to find housing. Because let's face it, the people we work with, they can't afford a newspaper.
That's right.
And it's not as easy as saying, well, then go to the library and get one, right? People have to have access to transportation to get there. And the reality is people living in poverty today and on welfare today, like a single-parent mother in the same situation I was in 1984, are worse off than I was in 1984. And that's the reality of the day. So it's not as easy as saying, go to the library.
Right, right. Looking for a place to rent may not even be an option if you don't know what to look for, even if you can see something in advertisements in the newspaper
mm-hmm.
and you don't even know how to rent a house. You may not have ever done that before because you may have lived with someone all along and then suddenly you're on your own
mm-hmm.
and not have those skills to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And what about people with certain cognitive disabilities? Perhaps they don't have an advocate and they can't do that on their
yeah.
own.
Well, with the housing today, it goes even beyond that. The reality is there's not enough housing for people.
Right.
And I know that, our leadership honestly thinks that this is something that's just started with this economic boom. For many, many years, those of us in the anti-poverty sector have been trying to warn everybody that there's been a housing crisis coming down the tubes. This is not new, folks. This has been there. It's just now hit crisis proportions
right.
that, you know, we've never seen before.
Now we have people with full-time jobs, and we have people who are trying to get their education who are actually homeless.
Yeah, we see middle-income people moving back with mom and dad,
yeah.
and that's not fair to mom and dad.
Yeah.
They got them out the door once. They shouldn't be having to try to do it the second time.
Exactly, yeah. What have we got left, Jim? About a minute?
Minute and a half.
Okay. When we come back, we're currently talking to Bonnie Morton from the Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry, and we're talking about what the ministry does, how it's been affected by recent government cutbacks and funding to advocacy groups, and we're talking about the individual advocacy for the last little while that they provide to people who are living in poverty. When we come back, we're going to get a little bit into public education and the social justice aspect of the anti-poverty ministry. So join us, and we'll be talking about that when we come back on Human Rights Radio.
There's no time for us. There's no place for us. What is this thing that builds our dreams yet slips away from us? There's no chance for us. All the
And that was Queen, Who Wants to Live Forever. It's a video about poverty. You should have a look at it if you have a chance on YouTube. Who Wants to Live Forever. And, quite a powerful video. Good music. I'm a Queen fan.
Welcome back to Human Rights Radio. We're talking with Bonnie Morton of the Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry. And before we went for our break, we were talking about individual advocacy as the Anti-Poverty Ministry has a mandate to work in that area, as well as public education and social justice. And before we left, the concept of advocacy for people and with people and the rights and responsibilities were raised. And I wanted to have Bonnie talk a little bit about systemic advocacy. If you could take that away and give us a little bit of conversation about, sort of to explain what systemic advocacy is about in relation to poverty, Bonnie.
Systemic advocacy would be the next step to the individual advocacy, other than the public education, which we need to do so that when we're working to, systemic advocacy really is lobbying to make a change. That's what it's all about. And I know that in this day and age with the tax system, you have to be careful of using the word lobby. But that's what we do when we want to make a change, is we stand up and we speak out for what needs to be there. So you can't just do the individual advocacy and see yourself winning at, say, getting special diets for people and think that the system's going to change itself. It won't. What needs to happen is we need to step in and we need to push that system and educate that system as well as to why that social policy needs to change. If you're winning something over and over again, that tells you the policies they have in place aren't really working for the reality and the needs of the day. So we need to work to make those policy changes. And the way of doing that is the public standing up and working or speaking with government or government officials and bureaucrats to move and change things forward. When we talk about social policy, it should be something that's fluid and moves with the day. So if something is a need today that wasn't a need yesterday, we need to ensure that that gets covered today and tomorrow and the days after. But it needs to be, social policy needs to be flexible enough to meet the realities and the needs of the day. So systemic advocacy is about trying to speak to those in the power to make the changes. An example would be with social policy, like around welfare. We would start by meeting with bureaucrats, and then we might step that up by meeting with maybe the deputy minister, and then we would meet with the minister responsible. In our case, it would be the Minister of Social Services. Over the years of our ministry being in place, we used to meet quarterly. At the invitation of the Minister of Social Services, we met quarterly with them so we could tell them how their policies were affecting people and things like that. But under the government that we have today, we've met, our ministry has met once with the Minister of Social Services, and that's just in the last few months. They don't meet in the same way that other governments in the past have met with community organizations. What they do is they've set up a committee called the Human Resources Committee, it's the Human Resources Committee. And you go and meet with these people, and they're people that don't have any decision-making power. And they're supposed to go back and speak to the minister and tell them what they heard. But when we speak with the minister, not necessarily in a meeting like that, but out in the public where we've met with them or seen them, it's like they've never heard what we presented to those committees. So, or Human Services Committee, that's what it's called. So we have issues that we elect somebody like the Minister of Social Services, and then they're at arm's length and we can't get to them. Upon being elected, and this is my stand, or this is my take on political stuff, is that when we elect them, they become public servants, and they should be available to the public. And that means whether it is another bureaucrat or somebody from the Chamber of Commerce or the people that are affected by their policies, like people on welfare, there should be an open door for all citizens to be able to meet with those we've elected. So when I'm talking systemic advocacy, I'm kind of coming from that sense that my political right and responsibility is more than putting a check mark once every 4 years on a ballot. It begins the day that that political party is elected. And their responsibility begins by having the door open to be able to hear from the public. That's not the reality today. So then some of the systemic advocacy lands up into doing things like protests.
You know, that's an interesting concept. Back in the mid to late 1960s, I clearly remember a Senate committee that traveled across the country, the federal government, put together a committee to go across the country and visit cities and meet with people who lived on welfare. It was the Senate Committee Hearings on Poverty.
Yep.
And my mother dragged me out of class because the hearing they had in Winnipeg was at my school. And she came and took me out of class and said, "You're going to learn more here today than you're going to learn in your classroom, and I want you to come with me." We ended up on welfare after the death of my father in 1964, I believe. And this was shortly after that. And you know, Bonnie, I have to tell you, a lot hasn't changed.
No.
A lot has, but a lot hasn't.
That's right.
I remember my mother trying desperately to get enough money together to buy some decent clothing and at that time some nylon stockings so that she could go job hunting. I remember my mother using money for food to pay for a telephone so that a prospective employer could return a call. And my mother was a journalist. My mother did not grow up on assistance. It wasn't a generational thing. And we ended up on welfare after my father died. So I'm glad you talked about that protest, because thankfully the federal government at the time set this committee up. And the one thing I do remember specifically was towards the end of the meeting in the big auditorium in our school, my mother got up and invited all the senators to our home for dinner, because she wanted them to see what we had in our refrigerator and what kind of food she was able to afford to prepare for her family. Nobody took her up on that offer, though.
Yeah. Well, the reality is with the protests, if you have a government that's not listening to you or doesn't open the doors to be able to for you to be able to be heard, then your only option is to hit the streets and do that. With us around the systemic advocacy or the lobbying or whatever you want to call it, we realized that poverty didn't start here in Regina. So our work takes us beyond Regina. I've been involved in a number of organizations at the national level. I sit on the board of the Court Challenges Program, of which in 2006 the Harper government withdrew the funds from Court Challenges Program for any new litigation.
What was that program for? How did it work?
It was for doing test case development using the Charter of Rights and Freedoms to be able to get your rights under the Charter adhered to or recognized under the Charter, or if there was a violation that was very clear in the Charter, to be able to address it. But it was to give test case funding, and it was for people who couldn't afford to go to court. Now, if anybody's never been to court, you could be looking at anywhere from $250,000 to $500,000 for any level of that court system. So who's got that sitting in their back pocket? Now, I know I don't. And I don't know very many people in this country that can afford $250,000 for one level of a court hearing.
Right.
And to get your rights adhered to. And the Court Challenges funding was put in place so that you and I and other people that can't afford to go to court could do it and get the Charter of Rights to protect our rights. And a lot of times those rights are being protected against decisions our governments have made. Now, the Harper government said, well, this is pretty stupid. We're paying all this money out to challenge ourselves. So what do we have now? We have a government that we can't challenge. They're bringing stuff in that doesn't really assist us at all. It impacts most of us drastically. So now they've taken away the right to use the legal system. And to say that we all have the right to go to court is totally different than us having that right to go to court, because there's a financial impact or
right.
reality on it. So
exactly.
Yeah.
And the other thing is for those of who don't know the court system or the legal system, you can't get legal aid to do something like that.
No, legal aid won't cover that.
That doesn't cover that.
No.
Legal aid will cover family domestic issues, and it will cover criminal criminal liabilities and stuff yeah. like that. Yeah. So.
And I've been involved in other national organizations like the National Anti-Poverty Organization, which is now the Canada Without Poverty. And it's a group of people living in or have lived in poverty working to make social change at the federal level.
Mm-hmm.
But we already know that in 1995, Paul Martin acts the Canada Assistance Plan Act, or the CAP, and brought in the CHST, which meant that all of our provincial governments now are all on their own when it comes to social policy, and especially around economic policy that affects the poor. So there's very few protections within the CHST or the CST now. So when you realize that your federal government isn't working to protect you either, then you have to look at other avenues. When I was in university, I was fortunate to have taken some international law classes with Professor Youssef Klai. And he taught me a lot about the covenants that Canada has signed. Canada, the UN in 1966 ratified the Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights Covenant and the Civil and Political Rights Covenant. And those two are supposed to go hand in hand. Well, because of our political makeup in Canada, Canada cannot ratify those kinds of covenants unless every province and territory agrees to live up to and abide by the rights that are within those covenants. So the Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights Covenant is around adequate housing, adequate benefits when in need, food, clothing, that kind of stuff. So it talks about adequate, right? So in 1993, being part of the Charter Committee on Poverty Issues and NAPO, I brought this information to the table and I said, why are we not going to the United Nations? Canada has to report every 5 years. Canada's the only one reporting. But no other voices are coming from Canada except from the government. So in 1993, these poor people were given leave and we were the first NGOs ever to present a case before a UN committee of that kind. So since 1993, the Charter Committee on Poverty Issues, the National Anti-Poverty Organization, which is now Canada Without Poverty, we present cases to the UN. In 2006, I was invited to be one of the participants that presented a case against Canada at that UN body. And we gave our presentation, and a day or two later, the government gave theirs. And I am not kidding. I sat there, and so did many others, wondering what country Canada was talking about, because it sure wasn't the one that we live in. It was made to sound so good. But we were able to give information to this international committee that they had enough to be able to start questioning our country as to why the difference in the two presentations. And our government or the committee member or our government representatives had an awful time trying to explain stuff. They had to go away with many of those questions that committee had to have to report back later. So, and I mean, when they reported back, we get copies of that, mm-hmm. and then we could respond as well. And I mean, I'm sitting in this one committee hearing, and somebody from the Canadian government, because we raised the withdrawal of the funding from Court Challenges Program, and one of the committee members asked the question, and the government said, oh, the Court Challenges Program, they decided that they didn't want to continue doing ongoing stuff, right? So they made it sound like Court Challenges was the one that was responsible for the funding to be cut. And, of course, I'm sitting there, and I stood up and I said, but that's a lie. And, of course, I was ruled out of order. Mm-hmm. But later, I was called into the back room to ask what I was talking about, and I said he lied. I sit on the board of the Court Challenges Program. I was able to let them know that. So when they came back, they really hit Canada hard with that. And they've been calling for Canada to put the funding back to Court Challenges Program, to put funding back to women's organizations, and calling on them to do what they can to eliminate poverty in Canada. And they've been doing that since 1993. But it's only been since that alternative voice has been there. So now what do we see our governments doing federally and provincially? Removing funding from the alternative voices.
Right. Let's move into another area.
Okay. So you let me go on those rants.
I think you've made your point very, very well, very clearly, Bonnie. I would like to go back into your annual report, and not because I want to leave what you've been talking about,
yep.
because it's so incredibly important for us to know about. But I'd also like to talk about something else that I believe is equally important, and it goes back to individual stories.
Yep.
And in your report, you talk about how you are gathering stories from people in poverty for the low-income anthology, which is an avenue for people living in poverty to tell their stories in an anonymous way. The complete anthology will be used to sensitize church members, government officials, and the general public on the struggles faced by low-income people. And the reason I want to bring this up is not only because it's so important for those people, but also because I was involved in something like this a while back, a number of years ago when I worked with some of the street people. And I was running a little bit of a program, a writing program for young people that were living on the streets. And I collected stories, and I encouraged them to write their stories and create a rap song, that sort of thing. Some of it I kept, but one of the most profound things that I ever heard from a young man who used to walk around creating his own raps, and he was clearly a brilliant young man who had been homeless for a long time and had a lot of problems. One day I said to him, I need you to write about how you feel about living in poverty. Put something down. And he just looked at me and he sort of held up his hand because his fingernails were blackened. And anyone who works with people in poverty on the street knows why the fingernails are blackened, and that's because they're looking for cigarette butts, right? And then you take them apart and you can make a whole cigarette from it. And he held up his hands and he said, living in poverty? He said, look at my fingers. He said, when I have a pocket full of butts, I feel like a king. That's what living in poverty is like for me. And I've never forgotten that. It's always stuck with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always thought I wanted to put a book together. And I'm so thrilled to see that the Anti-Poverty Ministry is working on this book.
Yes. Well, the reality is if you don't know the people's stories, all people are numbers. And then it is so easy to let myths guide you in your thinking about people living in poverty and what social policy should be. So, I mean, when I go and I do speaking, I tell my story of how I was in poverty, right? And the things I had to go through and the struggles it took for me to get to where I am today. That's a face people can see.
Right.
These may not be faces, but these are stories people can relate to. I mean, if putting stuff like that on paper meant nothing, we wouldn't have such huge book sales about the lives of people, right?
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you something that is equally as important as the life of a king and queen or anybody else in this world, prime ministers, is the stories of people living in poverty. You want to see spirit and you want to see depth. Listen to them, read them.
Right.
And that's what we want to do. It's hard for us to be able to do the work we do without being able to relate people's stories. So we need to do that.
Absolutely. What are we looking at? 5 minutes? Okay, great, Jim. I'm glad. That's wonderful. So when can we expect to see this publication?
Well, we need to get more stories.
And how would one get a story to you if one were to know someone or be looking at an opportunity to tell their story?
If they want to tell their story but they can't write it.
Mm-hmm.
And with a lot of people that we've done this anthology with, they just contact our office. We have another room that's separate where they can tell their story and nobody mm-hmm. else is going to hear it except the person running the tape recorder and asking the questions. They will have to sign a consent form for us to be able to use their story. But mm-hmm. what we would do is we would initially tape their story. We would transcribe that, get it back to them, and then we would work with what they, if they agree with it, and if they want to add something, they can, or delete something, we'll do that. Then we write the story, and then we get it back to them again to make sure that they're okay with what we're going to write. And they have to sign another release saying that they agree that that's the story that they can release.
Wonderful.
So it's always being guided by the folks that are telling their stories.
Yes.
So if there's people out there that want to tell their story, please call our office.
What's the number?
It's 352-6386.
That's great. I think that's so exciting. Where would you like to go from here? We have a couple of minutes left. How would you like to finish off this story? We could talk about disability. We could talk about
Income Support Coalition, the DISC. The Disability Income Security Coalition is a coalition that started a few years ago because, as I said earlier, that approximately 80% of the caseload, long-term caseload on welfare are people with disabilities. So in this country, we don't have program, well, in this province, we don't have programs for people with disabilities that have never worked before. And the default program has become welfare. So every time the public calls for cutbacks, people with disability are the recipients of those cutbacks. They live in it day in and day out. And most people in this province would not support treating disabled people that way. So we've called on the government to bring in an independent welfare benefit program for people with disabilities, and it's called SED, Saskatchewan Assured Income for Disability,
right,
otherwise known as SED. Mm-hmm. So it's a new program, but right now they're in the midst of trying to work people who are on welfare and set up an assessment tool, figure out who's going to go into it, because it's long and enduring disability, not just a short-term.
Rather than having to report every single year,
yep,
to your social services worker and prove that you still have your disability and you're worthy of being on assistance.
And
that's the way it's been in the past.
I was just going to say, my leg is still amputated.
Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we're also working because the benefit levels of people on welfare are not very high. They don't meet the real cost of living in our community,
right,
whether it's shelter, buses, whatever, right? Food, clothing,
mm-hmm,
doesn't meet that at all. And so what we're looking at doing is we're working in joint government community committees at setting up a benefit level that's socially acceptable for people on the SED program, so it will give them more money to live on. And
right,
so we're in the midst of developing that right now. So it's a good program right now. It's changed the name, but it's the same old game. And if the government doesn't move any farther on it, it'll be the same thing. So anybody out there that supports this program and making sure that people with disabilities get more money, call the Minister of Social Services office and say, raise the benefits to socially acceptable.
Okay.
And that's systemic advocacy, folks.
Yes, it is, because you're working within the system. Absolutely. I think we need to wrap the show up.
We do.
We've only got a minute or so left.
Yep.
Bonnie Morton from the Anti-Poverty Ministry. One more fast question and a real quick answer is, if someone would like to volunteer for your ministry, would that be possible if they wanted to come and talk to you about volunteering?
Yes.
Okay. And they can contact you at bonnie.rapm, as in Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry, at sastel.net.
Yes.
Okay. Take it away, Jim.
Okay. As we close this week's Human Rights Radio on CJTR Community Radio, we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. To discover how you can contribute to the abolition of human rights violations, visit our website at amnestysaskatchewan.ca or check out our Facebook group at Amnesty International Saskatchewan and follow the links. For info on past shows, go to http://humanrightsradio, that's all one word, .podbean.com. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."